and welcome to the latest edition of the Mimiverse Monthly Audiocast. I am your host, writer-director Christopher R. Mim, and I have to ask because it's the thing I do. Are you there? Are you listening? Do you know why I ask those things? Because every month I spend hours and hours putting together this audiocast and my monthly newsletter, and I send it out into the void, and then silence. I mean, not complete silence. People will buy things or occasionally send me a message, but the reason I ask is because I really don't know if anyone is listening. I know there are at least two people listening. Hi, Mom. Actually, my mom doesn't even listen. But I know there are at least a couple people listening because they'll often contact me about things I've talked about. But really, I just don't know. I get some information about how many times the file is accessed, but that doesn't mean people are listening. I don't know if that means, like, people are downloading it, or they're playing it, or it's just bots hitting it to put it on the sites that let other people know it exists, like Apple Podcasts. I just don't know. So I ask because I really don't know. So I guess I'll ask again. Are you there? Are you listening? I hope so, because there are a lot of cool things going on in the Mimiverse right now, and I want to share them with you. Because if you like my movies enough to listen to this podcast, at least two of you, I would hope that you're interested in all the fun things happening. Right off the bat, I guess I'll start with the most exciting news, and that's that we are, in fact, going to host a live in-theater world premiere of the most recently finished film, The Phantom Like Kids, in the day the Earth abruptly almost ended, the third in the trilogy, and realistically, probably the final Phantom Like Kids movie. I would love to make more Phantom Like Kids movies, but I don't want to get stuck in being the guy who just makes Phantom Like Kids movies, because I have other ideas that I want to get out there, and I love my children dearly, don't get me wrong, but there are other folks out there who I want to work with. And honestly, my kids are all starting to get a little older. My son, Elliot, who plays Danny Johnson, is like 20 this year, so it's like he's not even really a kid. Granted, by 50s movie standards, he can be a teenager until he's 40, but that's neither here nor there. The point I'm trying to make is, I just want to do some other stuff, and I don't want to bore you guys. Not that I'm boring you with these movies, but there are other things out there that I'm sure you guys want to see. And that's why I'm working on this new movie, Annihilate All Humans, which I'll talk about after this. It's the final Phantom Like Kids movie. Maybe we'll see them back in some capacity later. Maybe we'll do a Phantom Like Kids The Next Generation at some point. I don't know. For now, it's been a fun run. And the big news is that we're going to be doing this world premiere. Finally, after 3 years of not doing them because of COVID. The last one we did was in April of 2019, and that was for Queen of Snakes. And we were supposed to do The Beast Walks Among Us in April of 2020, but everything went to hell, and you know the rest. And so in that time, you know, I've been making Phantom Like Kids movies because, honestly, to a certain extent, that was all I could make. This is the final one, and I'm moving on to other things. I feel bad that the actors and crew people who've helped make these Phantom Like Kids movies have never had a proper premiere. And since we've gotten to the point in the pandemic where we're just learning to live with it, I want to honor them by having a real premiere. So we're doing it. July 27th. It's a Wednesday night. I really don't know how many people are going to show up. That said, the Heights Theater in Columbia Heights, where we're holding the premiere because that's where we've held all of our premieres, holds 240 people. Well, 239, but that's seats. That doesn't include wheelchair seats, but roughly 240, right? And in the interest of trying to stay safe in the age of COVID, I am going to play it by ear a little bit as far as how many people I allow in that theater. If numbers are bad, and you know, they've been sort of up lately, but if numbers are bad at that point, I'm going to cap capacity at half, so 120. And so that is the exact number of advance tickets I am currently selling. What? What did I just say? Yes, I'm currently selling them. They're available. And that's the big news, is that you can buy your advance tickets to the world premiere of The Phantom Like Kids in the Day the Earth Abruptly Almost Ended. They are available at SaintEuphoria.com. And again, there are only going to be 120 advance tickets. Because then, should we get to the day of the event, if the numbers are less than stellar, I simply won't sell any at the door. If, however, numbers are great and it's looking all right, I'll sell some at the door and I'll have some wiggle room in regards to how many additional people I actually let in. That theater with 120 people feels pretty dang full, but there's space. So if you're a person who's a little skittish about going to like a movie in the age of COVID, I understand. I have gone to several movies, but honestly, I'm usually the only guy there wearing a mask. And I'm going to continue to wear one, and I will be continuing to wear one even at the premiere. And in fact, as of right now, I feel like requiring people to wear masks to attend this premiere, even if they're just simple surgical ones, and we'll give them to people at the door. This is ultimately a private event. No one has a right to attend if I, the guy running it, say you don't. Which gives me some power, yes, but it's true. This is, in essence, a private event that I am selling tickets to, which means that I have some control over what happens. And as of right now, I feel the need to require everyone who attends to wear a mask, at least while you're not eating popcorn or drinking your drink or whatever, just to keep everybody safe. The last thing I want to do is have a super spreader simply because people didn't want to wear a mask. And if you are one of those people listening right now and you're like, I'm not going to wear a mask. Masks are dumb. I refuse. And you would have a problem with that, then don't attend. If that's just the way you see the world and you just don't want to be a person who has to sit in a theater for a couple hours and wear a mask, then don't show up. I'm not going to require that people show negative tests or vaccination status, although if things are really bad numbers-wise, I might. But I'm just saying it's open, right? It's not set in stone, except as of right now, if you attend, you will be required to wear a mask. And if you don't have one, one will be provided to you. You know, they don't have to be the K95 ones or the KF94 ones or whatever, although I'll be wearing that. But we will at least give you one of those surgical style ones you can get whenever you walk into a Target, right? And again, this is just to keep everybody safe. I don't want this to turn into some sort of super spreader. Here's a good example of why. This past weekend, my niece, and I won't say her name or where she lives, my niece, who lives in a smaller town in a different state, went to prom and didn't wear a mask. And my brother's family has been very careful about wearing masks in public and been very, very safe as far as being overly cautious when it came to COVID. And she went to this event and didn't wear a mask, which was literally the first time she went out and did something like this in a big group, not wearing a mask, feeling safe doing it because she doesn't go to a big school. She got COVID. She's fine, recovered, everything's good. I guess it wasn't this weekend, it was a week and a half ago. And she's fine, but she got COVID. And the prom turned into a super spreader. That's what I don't want. We're just there to celebrate a movie and watch a movie in a movie theater. Wearing a mask is not that big a deal. At least I don't think it is. I'm saying if you want to attend, you got to wear one. Hands down. No exceptions. Unless they cure COVID in the next 3 weeks. And then, hallelujah, we're all free and safe. But otherwise, everyone will have to wear one. That's just the way it is. If you don't want to, don't buy a ticket. But if you don't mind, I would love to see you there. I really, really would. So that's the thing that's happening. We're finally doing this premiere. Again, you can buy advance tickets. There were 120, but there are less now because they've been on sale for a little bit and people are buying them. And honestly, if you are really set on going and really, really want to go, you're going to have to buy advance tickets. Because once those 120 sell out, there is no guarantee at all that I will be selling them at the door. So those 120 tickets may be it. That may be all there is. And if you don't get one, you will not be able to go. Like, there's a good chance that may be it. I mean, when I go to the movies right now, I usually pick a movie that's been out for a few weeks, and then I go see it at weird times like Tuesday at noon because I'm self-employed and I can do that. And therefore, there's like four people in the entire theater. And I sit away from people and I wear a mask. And I know it's over the top. Some people are like, that's just over the top. You don't have to be that crazy. And that may be true. But I don't care. It's how I feel safe and how I want to live, and I don't care what other people think. For me, that's what I feel safe doing. So I'm going to impose that on everyone else. Because if we have 120 people in that theater, the theater's big, but there'll be people sort of sitting on top of each other a little bit and sharing air in a space. And so if we can all just do that simple thing, I think we'll be good. That's what's going on. That's the big thing. Big premiere next month. It's from when I'm recording this, about 8 weeks away, maybe nine. I haven't actually counted, but it's coming up. I've got the DVDs and Blu-rays all done. I just have to get them manufactured, but that takes about 2 weeks, and we'll be set and ready to go. So this is exciting to be doing this. Nerve-wracking because it's been a while, but regardless of that, it's going to be awesome. It really is, and I can't wait to do this again. And honestly, after not doing it for 3 years, I think it's going to be a good test of whether or not I want to continue doing these premieres. Something I've been dealing with a lot in the last, well, a couple months is really feeling the change that has been brought about in the last 2 years. The last 2 years have been insane, and so many things have just changed, and a lot of them subtly, but in important ways, like going to the movies. Things have just changed. In the last couple months, they've all hit me at once. You know, all the loss of people and friendships and relationships and deaths and just everything that has happened really hit me like a ton of bricks in the last couple months and made me really have to step back and take stock in what it is I do and who I am, even at times where it's just like, and this is probably deeper than you're expecting, but it's true. I think a lot of us have been forced into corners and really have had to confront things that we didn't want to or didn't even know were issues until you had no choice but to look at yourself in the mirror. Right? And you're probably like, what the hell is he talking about? But a lot of this is tied into my career choice to be a filmmaker. I've spent 15 plus years trying to build my movie empire. And very quickly, after feeling like I was really making some great progress, a lot of it felt like it came crashing down very quickly. And everything I knew and the way I looked at everything and the path I was heading down, which seemed so clear, now feels very different. Being punched in the face with that kind of thing can be difficult. I suffer from seasonal affective disorder, and this spring has been very difficult. It's been very gray, very gray. In fact, in the month of April in the state of Minnesota, we had 2 days with sunshine, 2 days. That's not good for someone like myself. So a lot of things were compounded upon each other and really sent me into a bit of a tailspin trying to figure out a lot of stuff and try to come to terms with how the future looks and what it looks like and where it takes me and what I want to continue doing. And sometimes I think in people's lives, these things hit us. Sometimes in people's lives, we just get smacked upside the head with reality and you have to break out of the fantasies you may have been living in that were comfortable, but not real. And reality hits you and kicks you and you're like, oh yeah, this is actually what's happening. This is actually who I am. This is actually where things are going. You have to be honest and readjust and deal with it, whether you want to or not. And that's usually the hardest part. And I guess this is the part of the podcast where I get into self-help mode, right? The new age, love yourself, part of the podcast. But no, a lot of this was tied around my identity as Mr. Filmmaker, right? As the guy who made cheesy movies and traveled around the country being the filmmaker guy, showing his movies to audiences. And that was always one of my favorite parts of being an independent filmmaker, was going to events and screenings and conventions and showing my movies and watching people watch my movies and kind of feeling a little bit like a rock star. And that has gone away. That doesn't exist. And I think to a certain extent, it never truly existed. And I just got wrapped up in it and realizing that it was never quite as amazing as I maybe made it out to be has been a bit of a shock to the system. But that said, I'm trying really hard to just be realistic and not undervalue the experiences I had or the fun I had doing that or why I still think it's important for people to get together and do things collectively, like watch movies together. Because it is important, regardless of what's going on in the world, we need to be around each other. We need to be social. We've all been so isolated for years now, and it's taken a toll on so much of our society. I talked about this with my wife, Stephanie, at length, about all the crazy that's going on in the world, especially in the United States, because we're nuts. I think one of the things about the COVID pandemic that's been really interesting, and I think it demonstrates too how different people cope with different stresses, in that you have sort of half the population who are completely freaked out by it and are maybe overcompensating for it and trying to avoid it and you know, really kind of retreated into their own bubbles, and people like me who still wear masks everywhere just for fear of getting COVID. And people like myself feel like I wish everybody was like that, because I feel like if we were, things would be better. Things would be more under control. Maybe some of that is an illusion of feeling like you have some control by wearing masks or whatever. But then the other half seem to deal with it by just ignoring it and pretending it doesn't exist. Like, ah, oh, well, you're going to die someday. Who cares? Right? But those two philosophies do not match. It doesn't exist, or it's the worst thing in the world. Those two things can't necessarily coexist peacefully. And I think that's part of the problem we're dealing with here, is you have some people who are overcautious and wish everyone else was overcautious, because then we'd all at least feel safe. And then the other half who think those people are nuts because you can't control it anyway and it's not real anyway, so who cares? And I think that's, I think, what's been fueling a lot of animosity and craziness in the last couple years. And it's all based around the uncertainty of it all, right? There is so much uncertainty with COVID, and 2 years in, we still don't really understand it very well, and it's still mutating like hell, and still spreading, and still people get it. Even the people who try really hard, even the people who went out and got their vaccines and boosters, and they're still getting it, right? It's not killing as many people, which is great, which should mean that it's mutating in the quote-unquote right direction. But there's still so many things about the disease we just don't know about, and we don't know about the long-term effects or what it could mean or what it does to your body and life expectancy. And there's just so many things about it that are just frightening as hell. And as a person who doesn't like medical stuff, it's basically my idea of hell, right? So anyway, I'm off on a tangent here, but I have dealt with a lot of these internal and emotional and mental changes of all of this, and really confronting them lately. And it's been difficult, but I feel like it's in the end going to be healthy to deal with these things directly instead of trying to let them fester and become toxic, because no one wants toxic things. Toxic things are bad. That's what the word toxic means. So all of that said, I got off on a tangent there about COVID. We're going to do this premiere. And as of right now, it's going to be capped at 50%. And if I feel safe when it comes to July 27th, I will sell some tickets at the door. If you want to join us, and I really hope you do, and you can, please do. Tickets are $15. Again, the kids deserve a proper premiere, and I'm giving it to them. Dang it. And they're all going to be wearing masks because I'm their dad, and I say so. And honestly, they all live here with us, so they kind of think like us as far as their attitude toward coronavirus. So they're going to wear masks, and we're going to have a good time. We're going to get dressed up. It's going to be warm. I mean, it's July, so I don't know if I'm going to wear like a full suit, but I'm going to be dressed up, because that's what you do when you do these premieres. You get dressed up. You're supposed to dress up a little bit. It's a chance to celebrate something, you know, an accomplishment. And in essence, to a certain extent, this premiere is not just for, I mean, we're only going to be watching the one movie, but it's really to celebrate all the family kids movies and the stuff we've been doing the last couple of years, which includes, you know, the holiday special and all that. So, I mean, this is definitely a celebration of hopefully coming out the other side of the COVID epidemic and trying to adjust and live again. Yes, we are all learning to live with COVID, and hopefully, given enough time, it'll just become a nuisance that, like the flu, we just have to deal with it. And that's kind of where it seems like it's going. going to have to get our COVID shots every year. I mean, it's just the way it is, right? And that's life. It's an adjustment. Things change. And the only constant in the universe is change, right? Things change. And you have to roll with it. Deal with the emotions that come with it. And adjust. Move on. Keep going forward. Because the only other direction is backward. And you can't really go back. It may feel like going back, but you're not, because time always moves forward, and so do you. So keep moving forward. So again, if you want to come and you want to be guaranteed to get tickets, buy them now while you have the chance, because there aren't that many available. Go to stuforia.com. You'll find them on the merchandise page. Okay, the other things going on, and I'll hit on this quickly here because I don't want this episode to be too long. Although I say that every month and they always seem to be really long. But before we actually get into this month's edition of An Oral History of the Mimiverse, I do want to say the other fun news is that principal photography of the next movie, Annihilate All Humans, has begun. It's going rather quickly since I finished the script, but that's good because there's a lot of stuff to film and there's a lot of special effects and there's a lot of things that need to get moving on this so I can get it all done for next year. But we have started shooting it. We've shot one scene so far, but that counts. And actually, in a few days, we'll be shooting a couple more. Next week, hopefully a couple more. It's one of those things where you just kind of bang away at it. That's the thing about making movies, right? Is it's a lot of little parts, and you have to do all the little parts, and then like a giant jigsaw puzzle, you put them all together, and suddenly you have yourself a movie. We're at the stage now of building that jigsaw puzzle where we are pulling out all the side pieces. That's the filming stage. So principal photography has begun. And if you want to see visual proof of that, just go to the June 2022 Mimiverse Monthly newsletter and you can see I posted a cool behind the scenes photo my wife took while we were filming of Jim Norgard playing Dr. Gabriel, Mike Cook playing Dr. Edwards, and Mark Hader playing General Castle. Now they're just sort of sitting on lawn chairs, so it really doesn't tell you anything about the movie. And of course the movie is about flying saucers attacking the world. So I'm sure you're like, well, what does sitting on lawn chairs have to do with that? But once you see the final movie next year, you'll figure it out. You'll know. But yeah, it's coming together. We're shooting it. Now is the time, of course, that I have to beg you for your money. The Mimiverse is only made possible by viewers like you. And that's through contributor credits that the movies get made. In this day and age, because physical media is not the powerhouse it once was, the only way the Mimiverse survives and thrives is through contributor credits. If you would like to see your name in the credits and maybe pre-order a DVD or Blu-ray, if you're kind of old school and like physical media like I do, contribute by going to stuforia.com, looking up Annihilate All Humans and contributing, you know, $20, $30. You'd be surprised how far $20 goes when you're making cheesy 1950s style B movies. It goes a long way. So if you want to see this movie, which is going to be awesome, everyone who's read the script is like, wow, this is a really good script, which I always like to hear that. If you want to see this movie, help out if you can. Again, the minimum contribution is like $20. That gets your name in the credits and you get the cool certificate. And if you want to pre-order DVDs and Blu-rays, that's a little extra, but then you're guaranteed a copy when it's done. And of course, I talked about this premiere for this new Phantom Lake kids movie as me sort of gauging exactly how I want to promote and present the films going forward. I mean, if it's just a bust, I think that just means that in theater premieres and screenings and stuff need to be rethought how we do them, where we do them, if we do them, right? So there's never any real guarantee that even if I finish a movie that there'll be like live screenings of anything, especially given the way the world is and how uncertain everything is. So one of the ways you can make sure you get a chance to see it if you still have a DVD or Blu-ray player is to pre-order physical media. I'm one of those people that sincerely believe that you should always buy the physical media if you really like a film or you really want to be able to always watch it. Because in the age of streaming, nothing is permanent. Not even the final cut of a film is permanent. Disney, for example, constantly goes back in and alters the edits of their movies and TV shows. They change things. they don't tell you when they do. So if you're used to a movie being one way and you watch it, you know, on streaming and then come back to it a year later, it may not be the same movie. So if you ever want to make sure you get a movie the way it was originally intended to be released, for good or bad, buy the physical media, because no one can take that away from you. With the uncertainty of the way streaming works, you don't even know if something's going to be available at any given time. Amazon used to show all my movies for free to all the people who had the Amazon Prime memberships. Now you got to pay for them on Amazon. If you really like one of my movies, are you just going to continually rent it? Or just throw 20 bucks at me and buy the Blu-ray and watch it whenever you want all the time? That's the thing. I'm of a mind that I'd rather own a physical copy so that, again, no one can take it away. And if I want to watch it at any given moment, I don't have to search for it, hope it's free, and if it's not, pay again. I paid the one time, I can watch it whenever I want. Plus, the quality of physical media is still better than streaming, because streaming has to deal with bandwidth issues and internet dropouts. And, you know, how many times have you been watching a movie and it stops in the middle and buffers or just looks like crap because so much else is going on that your bandwidth is too low? I know it's happened to me and I hate it. I'd rather just throw a disc on and know I'm going to get the exact quality of what I'm looking for. So yeah, that's my little rant about physical media. Plus, if you're interested in helping out independent artists like myself, the best way to support independent artists, especially ones who distribute their own stuff, is to buy their stuff. Here's a little secret. The profit margin on a DVD is 10 times higher than on a stream. I don't want to say it's all about money, because it's not. It's about the creation. It's about the art. It's about the thing that you love that brought you in, the movie, the songs, the performance, the whatever. That's at its core what it's about. But the thing is you still have to survive. You still have to eat. You still have to pay your rent and your mortgage and your bills, right? And if you love something and want to help it survive, say you love a writer like Stephen D. Sullivan, the best way to support someone like Steve Sullivan is buy his books from him. That's how he survives. The way I survive is by making movies and people contribute to them, which please contribute to Annihilate All Humans, and by buying physical media. It's just the absolute best way to keep the Mimiverse alive. Support it in any way you can. And if you can't afford it, and I get that, life is expensive, at least spread the word. Help get people interested. Let people know that the Mimiverse exists and it's worth their time to check out. All that stuff helps. And I want to thank you, because I know if you're listening to this, you're one of those helpers. You have done your part, and I appreciate you. Thank you very much for supporting me. On that note, I think it's probably the perfect time to move into this month's edition of An Oral History of the Mimiverse. So in last month's episode of An Oral History of the Mimiverse, I basically glossed over Destination Outer Space because there was very little about it that was really worth talking about. So much about it was just negative and sad, and I don't know, I just don't have a lot of great memories of it, so I figured, why dwell on it? This month, though, we start getting into Attack of the Moon Zombies, which, for me, I've always considered the beginning of the second era of the Mimiverse, because I feel like you can really break down the Mimiverse into several eras, and I've talked about this before, the first era kind of being the Josh Craig era. And this is where we get into what I call the blockbuster era, where I really started to feel like I was branching out into trying some bigger, more ambitious things. And you can see that in the films that I include in this era, like Moon Zombies and House of Ghosts and The Giant Spider, the late night double feature, and Danny Johnson Saves the World. So I feel like Moon Zombies was really the beginning of that, where I really wanted to step out of the smaller mindset of some of these early films, like The Monster of Phantom Lake, which was small. It was people in the woods and a monster attacking them. It came from another world. It's six people in the entire cast, you know, cave women, small cast, mostly shot outside, one set. Terror from Beneath the Earth, which again, tiny cast, you know, one or two locations. Sure, there was some ambition in building a damn cave in my basement, but still small. Destination was an attempt at something bigger with lots of locations and spaceships and stuff, but it just, to me, felt like, in retrospect, a misfire. But I think when it comes to moon zombies is where it really starts to become something bigger. It started out originally as a different script that I sort of started before settling on Terror from Beneath the Earth, called Attack of the Killer Robot, which would be about a killer robot attacking people on a moon base. But that script never really took off very far. And at the time when I was writing that, it seemed way too ambitious for what I wanted to do, especially coming off the death of Shadow Creek Studios. So I thought, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to do something bigger. And I took some of the basic premise of Attack of the Killer Robot and changed it up to be Attack of the Moon Zombies. And the moon zombies were something I came up with, which are just kind of plant monsters that turn other people into plant monsters and plant monster zombies, basically. I mean, they're not traditional zombies, not in the voodoo sense and not in the George Romero sense, obviously. But at their core, they are zombies, right? They replicate by shooting spores in people's faces, and then they turn you into one, and you set about trying to create more, which is kind of the zombie thing, right? You want to eat brains, and you turn other people into zombies who want to eat brains. And so I wrote this script and thought, God, this is super cool. I think it's going to be great. To a certain extent, what's funny is that at the time, one of my motivating factors was that I said to myself, I want to write a script that makes people cry. I realized after making 5 movies that I really liked affecting people's emotions by making people laugh or being scared or whatever. And I was like, I want to see if I can write something that would actually make people cry, really kind of pull at their heartstrings. I remember when I decided on that, I was like, well, okay, if I'm making this Moon Zombies movie, how could I do that? And I was like, well, what if I take Dr. Edwards' character, Mike Cook, who I know is a great actor and I know he can pull this off effectively. What if I kill him off? But he dies heroically. And I was like, ah, that's a cool idea. And I remember I asked Mike Cook specifically if he was okay with it. And he said, you know, if it's done well, yeah, let's do it. And of course, it still works because it was in the future and he was much older. So it would still work out exactly the same way. I could still use his character if I just went back in time and did more stuff in the 50s, but not in the late 70s when this movie was taking place. And he was all for it. So I was like, yeah, let's do it. So I wrote the script and I thought it was great. It's a little deliberate, and I think if I were to write it now, I might have gone back and made some changes and maybe tightened it up a little, made it shorter. I mean, it's the longest movie I've ever released. It's like 100 minutes, 99 minutes, something like that. But I don't necessarily think much of the time is wasted. It's just paced a little older. It's a slow ramp up to the big finale. And I always liked the 3-day structure of it, trying to build it around the 3-act structure. I thought it was a good script. One of the really interesting things about this time, because it was 2010 now, my son David, my youngest, who you all know as Butch from the Phantom of the Kids movies, had been born in January. Originally, when I wrote the script, I wrote the Ripley character, who ended up being played wonderfully by Sid Corpy. I wrote that character to be played by my wife, Stephanie. However, she was nursing. We had Alice, who was only 2, and Dan, who was only 4. And it was just, she was exhausted and was like, I don't think I have it in me to play this character. So many lines, so much time. You know, she was working at the same time. It was just like, she's like, I can't do it. And I'm like, oh, it's fine, it's fine. In the final film, she ended up playing Dr. Rutherford, which is just a small character. And she's basically the first person attacked by the moon zombies. And she's in all of like 2 scenes. Originally, that character was going to be played by Sid Corpy. And Steph was going to play Ripley. But then when Steph was like, I can't do it. And I appreciate that she was honest about it. You know, it would have been much worse had she just plowed through it and been miserable the whole time, because that would have made me miserable seeing her miserable, but it also would have been miserable in the fact that it just would have been a fight, and if your heart's not in it, don't do it, right? Or you just don't have the energy level and understand it and can admit that, for as awesome as that role was and for as sort of excited as she was by the prospect of playing that character, she just did not have the energy to do it. Understandably so, with all those little ones, especially when I'm working and can't help. So it was awesome of her to relinquish that, and I asked Sid, and she jumped right on it. Now, a quick little side story about Sid Corpy and Anthony Kayser, which I've always thought was fun. They discovered the movies, as far as I remember it, around Terror from Beneath the Earth. Like, they had gone to the theater to see it, saw it on the marquee at the Heights, and stopped by just to see it, because they're like, oh, that sounds cool. What is that? I've never heard of that. Sid contacted me and was like, I want to be involved. And I was like, okay, cool. And she's like, look, I even won an award for acting in high school. And she sent me a picture of the award, which I still think is hilarious. And I was like, cool, okay. I had put her and Anthony in the tiny little role in Destination Outer Space as the alien people who walk by and say, greetings, wise one. And like, that's it, right? Just because they were excited to be a part of it. And I was always very excited for people who were excited to be a part of it. Because sometimes I always felt like enthusiasm trumps talent sometimes. Just because when you're dealing with such tiny budgets where no one's really getting paid, you have to be excited to do it. You have to really want to do it. It takes effort. It takes enthusiasm. It takes drive. Because money is not a motivating factor here. Because there is none. So Sid was very excited. And I found her easy to work with. So I was like, yeah, she could play Ripley. But this other story, I want to make sure I tell it. And honestly, I don't necessarily remember if this happened before I shot Moon Zombies or after. It's a funny story. And I'm guessing it probably happened possibly even before Destination Outer Space. And I can't remember the timeline of exactly when. But Sid had contacted me about wanting to be involved in the Mimiverse in some capacity. And then she made a point of saying, hey, you know, I live in this big old house in Minneapolis. And if you'd want to shoot a movie here, you totally can. Why don't you come and check it out? We even have this like malt shop on our third floor. It's really awesome. My husband and I live here. You should come check it out. And I was like, intrigued, because I'm always looking for places to shoot my movies, right? Especially because knowing I have access to a particular location allows me a certain level of freedom in being like, well, I could write a movie that takes place in a cool old house, which, as you know, ended up happening. But that's not where we're at in the story. She was like, so come on by. We'll give you the tour. And I'm like, okay. But in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't know this person. They could be totally crazy. They could be wanting to kill me. I don't know. So I agreed because I was intrigued. I wanted to see this house. And honestly, I never got a weird vibe off them. Okay, well, I got a little bit of a weird vibe off them, but I'm sort of naturally suspicious of people. It's just kind of my nature. And so I asked Dan Shervin, I was like, hey man, I'm going to go check out this house of these people who are fans of the movies and want to be involved. And they say, I have this cool little house and they want me to come look at it. Will you come with me so that if they try to kill us, there's just strength in numbers? Like, I literally was just like, I don't know these people. Be my wingman. And he was like, I'm in. So we went and visited and found out that Anthony and Sid were perfectly nice people and very open and generous with their house and genuinely interested in having us come and film in their house. But also making it really obvious that Sid in particular really wanted to be in the movies. It was fun. We went down there, we hung out, we saw their malt shop, we played pinball. It was cool. The funny part is that Dan totally came with in the hopes that neither of us would die, but to protect the other person. So I didn't disappear. I didn't disappear, and it all turned out okay in the end. But that's the story. So I'm putting together Moon Zombies. The funny thing is, like, all the things that had happened up to that point with Mark and Ruby stepping up to help me finish all the sets for Destination. I don't honestly remember if I mentioned this or not, because I was talking a lot about Destination Outer Space, and I'm pretty sure I did. But, you know, I'll recap. When we were making Destination Outer Space, Josh had basically said he really wanted to be involved in every facet of it, and he wanted to help me build all these sets, and he helped me build like one set, and then all of a sudden, I was left holding the bag, having to build all these sets for the movie, and Dan Shervin helped me out with one of them, but then Mark and Ruby, Mark Hader and Ruby Gallinati, who you know as General Castle, and Ruby as Gilliam in the Late Night Double Feature, they really stepped up and became my behind-the-scenes crew. And so when I was putting together the Moon Zombie script, Mark and Ruby were like, yeah, we're on board. Because I was like, okay, well, I'm building this script around the idea that we're going to need a lot of sets. And the idea was that the entire thing would take place in this moon base. And the moon base would have to be all sets. there would be no existing locations. We'd have to build everything. And they were like, yeah, we're in. We'll do it. And they did. They totally stepped up. I mean, they were there through all of it. And we worked out a process for how we had to do it. And it was arduous. It was a lot of work. And this is why I feel like this was the beginning of the blockbuster era, because I've gotten to the point now where a lot of the behind-the-scenes help I used to have no longer exists. A lot of what happens now, I do on my own, and my kids help me a lot. But then I kind of had this crew of people who were all interested in stepping up and helping. And there were sort of a ragtag group of people that I picked up along the way, probably Destination Outer Space, where I really ended up finding a cool, reliable group of people who were just interested in being a part of it and helping. Moon Zombies was sort of the pinnacle of that, because I really, really leaned on everybody who wanted to be involved. I mean, as soon as someone said, I want to help, it was like, okay, well, we're going to put you to work, show up at my house and help us build this set. And so that was probably one of the most difficult parts of making that movie. Now, it's also a long script. It's part of the reason why it's a long movie. It's got a lot of parts. It required costumes made by a costumer. There was a lot that just went into it. It was awesome to have all those people who were all focused on making my movies. It was really the beginning of this cool era of just having so many people who were really enthusiastic about it. And it was the beginning of that era, so everyone was extra enthusiastic about it, right? That was one of the best parts, was that it just felt like the sky was the limit. Well, the ceiling was the limit because our budgets were so small, but you know what I mean. People were invested. People were excited. People were there, and all these folks were just like, tell me what to do. Let's do it. And over time, people started to drift away. This is how things go. People come in and out of your life, some good, some bad, some good endings, some bad beginnings, and some good endings. You know, you never know. And so this was really fun to write a script that was so ambitious for what I wanted to do, right? I mean, the fact that I had to build, I think it was like 17 different sets, which is ridiculous. But then with that many people in the cast needing costumes and special effects and monsters and stuff, was really kind of going for it in a way that I hadn't before. And I think it works. I think it came together. The other thing too, and this is the biggest part of this beginning of this era, is this is when Mitch Gonzalez comes into it full throttle. He did a few little things for Destination Outer Space, Creatures in the Bar Scene. It wasn't the Moon Zombies. And that's the thing, is like the Moon Zombie is still one of the coolest designs of any of Mitch's monsters. And it's the one that people love. I mean, people love it. Again, it was way more ambitious than any other movie we've done, because it was one monster design, yes, but we still needed like more than one. I think he ended up making like 5 or 6 of them, molding it and making all these different masks and having different people wear them. And it was, again, much more ambitious, where it's like, no, we don't want just one monster. We need like lots of monsters. And that meant Mitch making multiple masks. I think that's where you see the really big jump in quality. And that's why I feel like, again, this new era begins, is we move away from paper mache and crappy stuff I throw together. It's not all crappy, but you know what I mean? It's just like lower quality, more homemade-ish quality stuff going to something that's professional level monster masks. And that raised the bar on what it is we could do and what it is I could create by having this ambitious script with all these really talented actors and multiple really high-end rubber mask monsters. And it was cool. And it was really nice to be able to do that, especially after writing this script that I was really a little paranoid about whether or not I could pull it off. And everyone stepped up. Shannon was really at the top of her game. I think she does a great job. But we got Doug Sidney in there for the first time. I loved working with Doug. I haven't really talked to him much since Guns of the Apocalypse. But he's busy. He's got a lot of stuff going on. And honestly, Doug and I were never like close friends. We worked together. If I had a job for him or a role for him or something, we would talk, but it's not like we hung out, you know? It's not like we exchanged texts like, hey, man, how's it going? It's always like, hey, I have a role. And if he was available, he'd do it. It's a positive working relationship. And that's it. A professional relationship. And so it was the first time we got Doug in there. And Sid really, really did a great job as Ripley. I think she really took that character where I wanted it to go and into places that are even better than what I saw. And Mike Cook was fantastic. And he really did exactly what I knew he could, which was pull people's heartstrings. Now, I'm not going to get much farther into the release of the film. Well, I'll save that for next one. But I will say, filming and editing Moon Zombies was pretty intense. Because there were so many scenes that required so much work, it was crazy, and it took a lot longer than I thought it would. We had gotten it down to a point, once we got all our cast in place, we had our costumes, and we were ready to film, and we were starting to build sets, we'd got the process down and in place to the point that it was like, and this is part of the intensity of it, was like every Tuesday and Wednesday, we would get together and build a set. And if we had to tear down an old one to build it, we would. We'd tear down a set, and then we'd build a new one on top of it. And then we'd shoot over the weekends. And it felt like almost every damn weekend. And we started shooting in like September of 2010, maybe even August. It was one of the longest shoots because there was just so much involved. It took a long time. And we had to spend a lot of time getting it together and doing everything we needed to do. And so we'd build a set, and then we'd shoot on it. And then I'd have to hope that I got everything I needed because a couple days later, we'd be tearing it down to build another one. And generally, the shoot went well. Ruby had built this really cool mechanism for the sliding door, which I thought was super cool, but it wasn't the most efficient thing because it used like a rope pulley thing. So you had to be behind the door, behind the wall of the set, and you'd pull the pulley to open the door, and then you could just sort of shut it by pushing it. It was clunky and heavy and not easy to manipulate to make it work. Quick story, because this actually plays into something later in the Mimiverse, is that Rob Wartick, who you would know as the guy who always wears the end is nigh sandwich board in The Giant Spider and then later shows up in The Beast Walks Among Us. Rob Wartick and then Bob Arndt, who plays the preacher guy. And Bob showed up in Moon Zombies as Dr. Banks, who's the jerky, flirty guy who gets spored in the face. Bob Arndt is my wife Stephanie's cousin. And he had found out about the movies and really liked them. He likes movies and wanted to be in a movie. So he and Rob are very good friends and have been for a long time. And so I was like, hey, I got this role for you, Bob. Come on down. He lives on the other side of Wisconsin. So it was like we had to coordinate a whole thing with him coming in from Wisconsin and spending the weekend and filming his scenes and all that. Rob, while he was there, because he was on camera for a little bit, and all he did is just sort of like tap Bob on the shoulder and then leave. He helped out while we were filming, being the door operator while we were filming those scenes with Bob that he's not in. And while we were filming, you know, the days get kind of long, and he would be stuck behind this wall of the set. And at one point, he started making jokes about how he was getting like hungry and thirsty. He couldn't leave his post, quote unquote, because he's operating the door. And he just started going, because he's behind the wall, he's like, the wall people are hungry. The wall people need something to drink. And it was like this ongoing joke that was really funny. The reason I bring up that story is pretty obvious right there. He came up with the name The Wall People. And after he said that, I had told him, I was like, I don't know what The Wall People is, but that sounds creepy. I want to use that at some point. And they're like, go ahead. And of course I did in the late night double feature. So again, the shoot of that was a lot of work, but I think it turned out pretty well. And a lot of people came in to be extras and be zombies. And I think it was cool. The shoot went well. The only real difficulties we had were in December of 2010, inexplicably, we got rain instead of snow. Like it was warmer out than it should have been. And we got like torrential rains for one night. And water seeped through my basement. We used to have water issues where water would come in the basement. And that's part of the reason why my studio is in that area. Because it's gotten so much water, it would cost so much to mitigate that it's not worth like finishing that room. So it's just like the furnace room and the studio, basically, and storage. But we got water on the set. So one of the weekends we were going to be shooting, we had to postpone a day because I'd gotten like an inch of water in the corner of one of the sets. And I had to go in and like shop vac it out and try to save it. It was like around Christmas time. It was crazy. It was like, why are we getting torrential rains in Minnesota around Christmas time? Why is it not just a blizzard? What is happening? And why am I getting so much water in my basement? It only lasted a day. and we got all the water out and everything was fine. But that was one of those things that was harrowing about it. I feel like harrowing is one of my new words that I use a lot. The other one was in January of 2011, the moon zombie flu ripped through the production, as we called it. One of my kids brought home the flu. It was a virulent year for the flu. I ended up getting it. Actors in the movie ended up getting it from us, and it was really bad. At one point, Mike Cook ended up having to go to the hospital because it was so bad, because he was having so much trouble breathing because he was coughing so hard. It was really, really an intense flu, and it knocked me down, and we ended up having to like postpone things because Mike was so sick. And I felt so bad. I was like, I don't want to kill my actor, you know? I mean, good Lord. As a result of this, and we were getting close to the end of shooting it at this point when the stupid flu ripped through the production, and something, you know, I'm really trying to avoid with this new movie with COVID, is we had three sets left to shoot on. It was like two scenes on one set, and then we'd be done with it. Then we move on to the next set. And then it was only then like two scenes on that set. Well, we shot one of the scenes on that first set, and then Mike got sick. And we were kind of starting to fall behind my arbitrary schedule I'd set for wanting to try and get it done and release the movie in May. So we hit a wall because we still had to shoot this scene with Mike, but he couldn't make it because he was sick. And so I was like, well, what are we going to do? We're going to lose like a couple weeks here of shooting time. And Mark and Ruby were like, well, why don't we just build the next set, shoot those two scenes, and then rebuild this one. And that was the one thing I tried so hard to avoid through the entire production. And it was like, you know, we're going to have to do it. And we did. I mean, it was the one time we had to do it. We actually had to tear down a set, build another one, and then put the old set back up. I don't remember exactly which set. I know that I think the set we put up on top of it was the airlock set. Mike Cook never appears in that set. I don't remember what the other set was that we had to take down and then put back up, but it really doesn't matter. But we had to take it down, build another one, shoot that stuff, and then when Mike was better, put that other set back up and shoot on that. That was a little bit of a scary little frustration, but it's a small price to pay to make sure that Mike Cook survived. Didn't want him to die. He's a really nice guy and a good friend and a talented actor. So that worked out. And finally, things had been just like going way longer than I thought. I thought we'd be done by like early January, and we were still going into February. The final day of shooting, and this is where I'm going to end this because it's fun. The final day of shooting, we were shooting the scenes in the geology lab where everyone gathers after the moon zombies start attacking the base. It was like a dozen pages. Right? And it was like two scenes or something like that. And we were going to do it Saturday and Sunday. And we were going to split it up because it takes about an hour per page to shoot anything, especially when you have a lot of actors on set. If it's only two or three people, you can rip through five pages in 2 or 3 hours. But if it's like six or seven people like it was, you have so much you have to cover that it's about a page an hour. So 12 pages, that's 12 hours. So I had originally scheduled everything to be 2 days worth. The thing is that Saturday was February 13th and Sunday was Valentine's Day. And everyone was committed to finishing this up. And so what if it's Valentine's Day? We're going to finish it, right? Well, on the 13th, we were all there and it was all the same actors who were going to be there on Valentine's Day who were there on the 13th. And at one point we had gotten through the first scene. So we're at like 6 hours, right? And we are all having some dinner, pizza or whatever, because it's always pizza, because pizza's cheap. Yay, Little Caesars. We were all eating, and it was like, we all just started discussing, well, we'll have to come back tomorrow. And I don't remember who said, well, I mean, does anyone have anything else to do today? And everyone's like, no, we're just doing this. I'm like, well, should we just keep going? Should we just finish it? And everyone was like, rah, rah, rah. Yeah, let's do it. No one else had anything else to do anyway. And then we all got Valentine's Day off, which ultimately is preferable to having to come and sit in my basement in the cold and film. And we're like, well, let's just do it. Let's do it. So we did it. We just plowed through 12 hours. It was the longest shoot day I've ever done. And we just plowed through it and got it done. On the last take, I yelled action. We went through it. We got it done. I said cut. And I punctuated the word cut by putting my fist through one of the set walls. See, there was one back wall that was really not attached to anything, but it was like a remnant from a previous set. And so for fun, and I wasn't angry or anything, it was more a celebratory punch, but also a way to just be like, thank God we finished this damn thing and I'm so sick of these fake walls. I just literally punched my fist through one of the little panel, wall panel things. And I did it partially to like startle everyone, which I did. Because I was like, cut, bang. And everyone was like, oh my God, what was that? And they saw what had happened. And I was like, yeah, we did it. And we all celebrated. It was awesome. It wasn't a, I'm so frustrated, I'm going to punch the wall kind of thing. It was more just it was a celebratory punch through the wall. And everyone celebrated. And we're all like, oh yeah, this is awesome. And it was over. We finished it. We got it in the can. Thank God for that. And I think that is the perfect spot to stop. There's still a lot that happens after we finish shooting and the editing phase and the premiere and the promotion of it. But I'll talk about that next month, seeing as that was the perfect spot to stop. I punched a hole in the set because we were celebrating. Yay, we did it. Moon Zombies was in the can. Thank you for listening to this month's edition of An Oral History of the Mimiverse. Stephen D. Sullivan and Saint Euphoria present Atomic Tales, stories of science, mystery, and excitement. This episode features the latest installment in our fantastic original series, Strange Invaders. Tonight, Agent 3 and Dr. Shannon Tarragon pick up a troubled hitchhiker in Chased by UFOs. Join us now as we present another in our continuing series of Atomic Tales.
I know you're frustrated, Shannon. I told the young Dr. Tarragon as we rode through the forested mountains of East Yosemite. I am too. I didn't think interviewing Donna Hayes would be any problem. We've always been friends, even if she is 50 feet tall now. I remembered a time earlier in the year when I had helped rescue Donna from a phony flying saucer cult. Things sure had changed since then.
Drat that Agent 8.
Dr. Tarragon cursed.
Pardon my language, Agent 3. I understand she's his wife, but I only wanted to run a few harmless tests.
I nodded sympathetically. Unfortunately, Bill didn't see it that way. And call me Suzanne, or just Rock if you prefer. We're off duty after all, she chuckled.
Well, when you're part of the U.S. Science Bureau, you're never off duty, Rocky. But I take your point. We need to relax while we can, because you never know when another giant insect...
Or a 50-foot woman, I put in.
Or 50-foot woman is going to show up, which is exactly my point. The bugs are nearly impossible to get samples from, because they disintegrate as soon as they're killed, and we haven't been able to capture any live specimens yet. But this subject, I mean Agent 8's wife...
Donna,
is just sitting there, lounging around their pool, soaking up the Nevada sun, while 8, Bill... recovers from his rattlesnake injury.
That comment made me wince, so I tried not to show it. Bill had gotten wounded on an expedition I'd led. It can't be easy in their situation. Donna becoming a giant is a big life change, no pun intended, and I'm sure keeping her under wraps only adds to the stress. With all that, I can understand Bill being cautious, especially after what happened to Dr. Hedison.
But her giantism is a completely different mutation from the Mansect. I wasn't going to try to cure her, just... find out what's happening with her biology. I have to tell you, Rocky, look out!
I slammed on the brakes of the agency Studebaker and cut the wheel hard, barely avoiding the scraggly vagrant who stepped out of the twilight shadows into the road in front of us. As we skidded to a stop, he staggered to the passenger side of the car. He looked like an extra from a Brando film, maybe 20 years old, slick black hair, jeans, white t-shirt, and beat-up leather jacket.
Are you out of your mind?
Shannon shouted.
We could have killed you!
He reached through the passenger side and tried to grab her.
You have to help me!
Shannon leaned away from him, but I already had my pistol in my hand. Back off! I chambered around to make sure he knew I meant business. He put his hands up and backed away.
I'm sorry, I need a ride.
Shannon eyed him suspiciously.
What are you doing out here alone?
He rubbed his scalp, and I noticed for the first time that he sported a nasty cut on his forehead.
I had a motorcycle accident,
he said.
I've been walking for miles. I need to get to Las Vegas as soon as possible.
Shannon and I glanced at each other. His story seemed plausible. She shrugged.
We're headed for San Diego, but we can take you part of the way.
Great,
he said, heading for the rear passenger door. I scowled. Nothing doing, Buster. I want you up front where I can keep an eye on you. Mind getting in back, Shannon?
Not at all.
She scrambled into the back seat as he got in the front. Sit near the door and keep your hands to yourself and we'll be fine, I warned. I started up the Studebaker and got us underway again. What's your name?
Larry Yavin.
Shannon leaned over the back of the seat to chat.
Why are you in such a hurry, Larry? Getting married in Las Vegas?
Larry looked over his shoulder, but not at the dock, out the back window. He drummed his fingers nervously on the seat back.
No, I need to talk to someone. I need help with a problem.
I frowned. What kind of problem?
You'll probably think I'm nuts, but I'm being followed by flying saucers.
Shannon arched her slender eyebrows.
Excuse me?
Yeah, they've been trailing me ever since I left San Francisco. Look, there they are now.
He pointed out the back window where the sky was fading from sunset to starlit night. I glanced in the rearview mirror at a pair of bright pinpoints in the distance. Just another car behind us.
Rocky?
Shannon said.
Those lights are too high up for headlights.
Helicopters, then? Larry pounded frantically on the seat back.
I'm telling you, it's aliens. They're after me. Drive faster.
It couldn't hurt to speed up,
Shannon suggested. She kept peering out the rear window. I remained skeptical, but accelerated anyway. Larry kept babbling.
They know about UFOs in Vegas. The Nevada test sites attract them. I'm sure she'll know how to get rid of them.
She who?
Shannon asked, her scientific curiosity piqued.
Sister Starlight.
I let off the accelerator. You're going to see Sister Starlight? Now that was one hell of a coincidence. Since when is this fruitcake in Vegas? You know she's a fraud, right?
She used to be a fake, but now she's for real. She's seen the lights, and they tell her things. She knows all about flying saucers and aliens.
Shannon grabbed Larry by the collar and yanked him back against the seat. She glared at him.
Who put you up to this?
Nobody. I heard her on the radio. She's got a weekly show.
Banana oil, I shot back. I suppose you don't know that I was the one who busted her in the first place. I've half a mind to dump you out of this car without stopping.
No, please don't. They'll get me. They're coming. Look!
I wasn't sure what kind of scam Larry was pulling on us, but those lights in the sky were closing in fast, whatever they were. I decided to put the pedal to the metal once more. Shannon, if I give you the high sign, dump this guy.
Right.
She scrambled over onto the bench seat between me and our squirrely passenger, flashing him a wicked smile as she settled in.
Don't think I won't, Larry.
I believe you. Just drive faster.
I did, but it didn't matter. Unhindered by having to stick to a road or avoiding intervening trees and rocks, the copters, or whatever they were, easily outpaced us. I ducked instinctively as one of the two flashed overhead.
Oh, no, 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 no!
Larry babbled. The air smelled like a lightning storm as a spotlight brighter than the sun filled the sedan's interior and the Studebaker's engine went dead. Shannon and Larry threw their arms over their eyes, shielding them from the glare, but I didn't have that luxury as I struggled to keep the car under control. With a bang like a shotgun, the left front tire blew out and we swerved toward a cluster of boulders amid the tall trees. I guess we must have crashed, and maybe my head smashed into the steering wheel, because the next thing I remembered was opening my eyes with the Studebaker's nose in the rock pile. Ghostly silence reigned, and the dazzling white light still surrounded us. I didn't see Larry, but the passenger side door hung open, and Shannon was sliding out of the car. Shannon, no! I reached for her, but she seemed to be sleepwalking as she stepped out into the dry ground between the boulders. She gazed blankly at the sky, her mouth gaping, the brilliant light painting her face deathly pale. I found my gun and forced my aching body to slide across the bench seat. Shannon, stop! She kept walking toward a gap in the tall rocks. I leaned out of the car, shielding my eyes with one hand and aiming my pistol with the other. I couldn't see what I was shooting at, but... The light flashed even brighter, and a sound like thunder rattled everything, including my brain. And when my vision cleared, the light had gone, and Shannon was sitting on the ground next to the car.
What happened?
Damned if I know. Just then, Larry stumbled out from a gap between the boulders.
Hey, what's going on? How did I get out of the car?
I shook my head and shrugged. I'd say we all barely avoided being kidnapped by flying saucers, but...
Oh my gosh! The UFOs!
Shannon sprang to her feet and did a quick circuit of the area. As she returned to the car, she sighed.
Well, whatever they are, they're gone.
Larry rubbed his head.
Yeah, about that flying saucer stuff. I'm sorry, I must have bumped my head when I crashed my cycle. Those lights, I guess they could have been copters. I feel better now.
There is an army base near here,
Shannon noted.
Does that mean you don't want to go to Vegas anymore? I asked our newly rational passenger.
Why not? Vegas is as good a place to wind up as anywhere.
Well,
Shannon sighed.
You might want to stick your thumb out and catch another ride. We won't be going anywhere unless I can fix this car or we can raise someone on the two-way radio. One thing's for sure, though.
I raised one eyebrow. What's that? She grinned.
Looks like Ray Tyler isn't the only one who can wreck an agency car.
This has been an original story of Strange Invaders, part of our ongoing series of
Atomic Tales,
brought to you by Saint Euphoria Productions. Tonight's episode, Chased by UFOs, was written by Stephen D. Sullivan. It was produced and edited by Christopher R. Mim and read by Rachel Grubb as Agent 3, Suzanne Rocky Rockford. It featured Lisa Sancello as Dr. Shannon Tarragon and Peter Danbury as hitchhiker Larry Yavin. Be sure to tune in next month for more Atomic Tales. Please support the films of Christopher R. Mim at SaintEuphoria.com and the work of Stephen D. Sullivan via his Patreon at PaySteve.com. Join the conversation at the Monster Conservancy at SaveMonsters.com. All elements of this episode are copyright 2022 by their creators and may not be reproduced or reused without permission. Atomic Tales and Strange Invaders are trademarks of Stephen D. Sullivan, all rights reserved. This is the Saint Euphoria Audiocast Network.
Okay, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you can join us for the world premiere of The Phantom Like Kids in The Day the Earth Abruptly Almost Ended on July 27th at the Heights Theater in Columbia Heights, Minnesota. Remember, if you want to go, I highly recommend buying advance tickets, because if they sell out and I determine that I'm not going to allow more than half capacity, you won't be able to go if you want to go. So buy tickets at SaintEuphoria.com. Contribute to Annihilate All Humans, since we're making that movie and you like my movies enough to listen to this. I would appreciate it if you would contribute to help keep them alive. And remember, before I go, as I always say, be good. But if you can't do that, be good at it. I will talk to you again next month. Stay safe.